journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, June 30th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Iraqis rejoice as U.S. troops withdraw. Nativo Lopez defends against charges of voter fraud. And rising comic star W. Kamau Bell explains how he plans to end racism in less than an hour. Plus, this week's Empire notes on the coup in Honduras.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Today has been declared National Sovereignty Day in Iraq as U.S. troops officially withdraw from the country's cities and towns. As agreed in a bilateral pact signed early this year, U.S. troops are to pull out of most Iraqi cities today and completely out of the country by December 31st, 2011. Around 130,000 American troops will remain at two giant military bases near the Baghdad airport, serving only as trainers and advisors for Iraqi soldiers. The U.S. military has spent more than $100 million improving its largest bases in what some say indicates a permanent stay of U.S. forces in Iraq. But Iraqis are jubilant today as 6 years and 3 months after the start of the war, U.S. combat troops have withdrawn. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki declared those who think that Iraqis are unable to defend their country are committing a fatal mistake. Meanwhile, in just the past week alone, major attacks in three cities have killed almost 200 people in an apparent warning that Iraq's troubles are not yet over. Joining me on the line now is Raed Jarrar, Iraq consultant to the American Friends Service Committee, and Catherine Lutz, who's with the Watson Institute at Brown University and the author of The Bases of Empire, The Struggle Against U.S. Military Posts. Welcome, Raed and Catherine.
Thanks for having us.
Raed, let me start with you. We spoke to you just this past April about the prospects for Iraqi peace, and you were quite hopeful based on the bilateral treaty signed between the two countries. How do you feel today, as an Iraqi even, about U.S. troops withdrawing?
I feel even more hopeful. I'm very happy that the Obama administration is showing their commitment to the bilateral agreement of withdrawal. Today's step was one of the major steps in implementing the agreement of complete withdrawal. I hope the Obama administration will implement the other very important steps that include releasing all Iraqi detainees and includes a complete U.S. withdrawal that leaves no bases and no contractors and no troops behind by the end of 2011.
Let's talk about the contractors and the bases. Catherine, what does the presence of these two bases that are going to hold 130,000 U.S. troops mean, and what exactly is the agreement over the bases? Is there fear of a permanent U.S. military presence justified?
Well, absolutely, it's justified. I'm hopeful as Raed is, but I think...
Catherine, you're going to have to speak up. We have trouble hearing you.
I said I'm hopeful as Raed is, but I think we are right to be very concerned based on what the United States has done in post-war situations around the world over the last 60 years. The United States remains in Korea, where the war ended basically in the...
Catherine, we're going to have to call you back. Your phone is just too low in volume. And while we're doing that, I'll turn back to Raed with your answer to the same question. What exactly is the agreement over the bases?
The agreement is crystal clear over the bases. All bases occupied by the U.S. must be handed over to the Iraqi side. There are two lists of bases for handing over. The first list is for those bases that were handed over today. According to my information from the multinational forces announcements in Iraq and the Iraqi officials announced, announcements. There were around 150 bases and military posts that were handed over to the Iraqi side already. And there are around maybe another 101 that are outside cities and towns and villages that will be handed over completely to the Iraqi side before the last day of the agreement, which is now it's the last day of 2011, but it might change if a referendum took place, you know, it might become earlier. But I think unlike other agreements that the U.S. had, for example, with Saudi Arabia, where the U.S. Withdrew its troops but did not close its bases, the agreement with Iraq is actually better in this regard because it requires the U.S. to close all of its bases in Iraq and hand them over to the Iraqi side.
Catherine, let me turn back to you. Raed was explaining that 150 bases have been already turned over to the Iraqis and that the two major bases will close. The agreement is very good. What is your take on it?
Well, I think, yes, the agreement is a good one. However, the history of the United States in similar situations over the last many decades has been very different. In other words, the United States has stayed in many countries around the world after combat operations. So the United States remains in Germany, Italy, Korea, the Balkans. I mean, there's a number. There are almost 1,000 U.S. military facilities that remain in many countries which like Iraq, were decimated by war and in a quite vulnerable situation. The United States was able to keep troops and bases in those countries for decades.
And then if you examine those countries and their sovereignty, I mean, people don't think of Germany as lacking in sovereignty today. It's quite an independent state. If Iraq does go the way of Germany in terms of the U.S. military base presence, problematic as that base presence may be, is it still not a much better thing than people were perhaps hoping for?
Well, the United States military bases in places like Germany have had a whole series of problems associated with them, including environmental damage, a sex industry in the vicinity of those bases that has been very harmful to local communities. And so I think one has to look at this larger context of U.S. basing and a very large social movement that has emerged to protest the U.S. presence in many of these places. There's an ongoing quite massive protest in Italy, for example, of U.S. plans to expand bases there. So people do feel that questions of sovereignty, of the questions of crime, questions of environmental damage remain very salient for them.
Raed, let's talk about Iraq's stability and some of the violence that has happened in the past week and what you think the source of these recent attacks are. Conservatives here in the United States are saying that the withdrawal of U.S. troops means that Iraq is going to become more unstable once more, and now they can't turn to the Americans to, you know, rescue them. I mean, that's the sort of prevailing characterization of it. First, where are these attacks coming from, and how do you respond to these conservative arguments against the withdrawal?
I don't think these arguments are really conservative arguments. You know, real conservatives are not for interfering in other countries and invading them. Maybe some like neoconservatives or some interventionists who have been trying to find new excuses to continue the same old policy, the same policy that has been going on for the last 19 years with Iraq, are trying to say now, let's stay in Iraq to save Iraqis from themselves and to help them. It's just the latest excuse in a long, long list of excuses to occupy and interfere in Iraq. Now, Iraqis do not look at the U.S. as a peacekeeping force, of course. They look at the U.S. presence as a foreign occupation. The vast majority of Iraqis, three-fourths or more, according to most of the polls that were conducted in Iraq during the last years, want the U.S. to leave as soon as possible. So I don't think anyone looks up to the U.S. For help or for rescue. Now, Iraq went through different cycles of violence during the last 6 years, mostly because of the foreign occupation and because of the lack of a strong sovereign central government that can protect Iraqis. And the lack of a stronger, strong central government is linked directly to the occupation. Iraqis will never look at their government as a legitimate Iraqi government while it's functioning under a foreign occupation. The same way that the French people did not look at their government as a legitimate one when it was under the Nazi occupation, whatever the government was doing, you know. With the end of the U.S. occupation, I think that will help everyone in Iraq participate in their government and work for a better future. Now, the U.S. withdrawal, I'm positive that it will not be the last step towards stabilizing Iraq. It's not like Iraq will become a stable country tomorrow, but it's the first step, the first serious step towards creating a legitimate government and stabilizing Iraq on the long run.
Catherine, what does it mean that the U.S. soldiers on those last two bases can be apparently called upon by Iraqis if they need help, that apparently they're there to train and advise the Iraqi army in the case of greater violence as there may be in the coming months?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely crucial, that the paradigm, the idea that the United States is here to help, as Raed said, is there to help you, Iraqi security forces, that's the kind of thing that has been said for many years about Korea or the Philippines. The United States military was and is in those countries in order to help prepare those militaries to handle their own security needs. When 60 years later they're still preparing those forces to take care of security needs, one has to question what the true motive is for standing at the ready. Whether it's really to have that presence, have that military readiness to do whatever is needed in the region, not just, again, in terms of an Iraqi security need as defined by Iraqis.
Catherine Lutz is author of The Bases of Empire, The Struggle Against U.S. Military Posts. I'm also speaking with Raed Jarrar, Iraq consultant to the American Friends Service Committee. We're talking about National Sovereignty Day, which is today. It's been declared today in Iraq as U.S. troops officially withdraw. 130,000 remain on two military bases, and they are to also completely withdraw by December 31st, 2011. Now, Raed, I want to quote from an op-ed that Michael Rubin of the American Enterprise Institute had in the Wall Street Journal today. He talks about the transition between Bush and Obama and what it means for Iraq, saying the surge was as much a psychological strategy as it was a military one, talking about the surge in U.S. troops in Iraq. He says it proved our adversaries' propaganda wrong, violence dropped, Iraq received a new chance to emerge as a stable, secure democracy. By telegraphing a desire to leave, Mr. Obama reverses the dynamic. In effect, his strategy is an anti-surge. Troop numbers are not the issue. It is the projection of weakness. How do you respond to that?
2 points here. Number one, the current plan that is being implemented is not really an Obama administration plan. For those who are trying to make like Bush versus Obama or Democrats versus Republicans argument here, it doesn't really fit because the bilateral agreement was signed by President Bush. And the withdrawal and all of the details that were signed by President Bush himself, not by Obama. Obama is just implementing the agreement that was signed by Bush. Now, the other point here is that we're not talking about what the perception of the U.S. is or how Iraqi dynamics are linked to what Iraqis think of the U.S. You know, Iraqis are not children waiting for someone to stand in their home and hold a big stick so that they won't fight among each other. I mean, this condescending racist arguments have been said in the last few years. I personally, I'm against them. I think Iraqis do not need anyone to babysit them with a big stick or a small stick. They should be left alone to run their country by themselves, to deal with their differences by themselves. And this is what the majority of people want. I believe that Iraqis do have the capacity and the will to deal with their problems and run their country by themselves.
Raed, I want to ask both you and Catherine to talk about the price that has been paid by Iraqis over the past 6 years as a result of the U.S. occupation. I mean, the U.S. may be leaving, Saddam Hussein may be gone, and Iraqis are certainly justifiably overjoyed. But how do you quantify this price? The country's infrastructure has been devastated. Women's rights have been set back. Community relations have suffered. And not to even talk about Abu Ghraib and the detainee abuse and the horror and humiliation of torture. This is a huge horror that has taken place over the last 6 years by any standards, right?
Well, I mean, you're right. In fact, the occupation has not ended yet. We're talking just about the first step. Now, until the occupation ends in 2000, at the end of 2011 or earlier, that's only the first major stage in rebuilding Iraq. But Iraq will need a long time to rebuild itself. I mean, the destruction that was caused by the U.S. wars in the last 19 years and by sanctions and by the former Iraqi government is huge. The destruction was huge. The destruction that was caused during the last 6 years alone is just monumental. I mean, we're talking about 1 million people killed and 5 million people displaced. The entire infrastructure of the country is destroyed. People are not overjoyed because of their current situation. People are overjoyed because they are getting rid of the foreign occupation. And they think that that is the major reason for the disasters that have been happening to them. But until Iraq becomes a free and stable place, we will need another maybe 5 or 10 years to rebuild the country. The size of this devastation is huge. So, I mean, have no mistake. It's not like Iraqis are happy now because they don't have a dictatorship and the U.S. is leaving and they will go on living their lives from tomorrow. They are just overjoyed by the end of this occupation, that the signs are telling them that the occupation will be over and that they will start the process of rebuilding their country, start the process of reconciliation, and start the process of real reconstruction that will make Iraq a functioning state again, like it used to be in the past.
Catherine, final thoughts on the same?
Well, just to give one example, one of the bases that's closing, Comanche, used to be a Ministry of Agriculture site. The BBC reported and that base is being returned to the ministry. They come to this area and find, of course, that all of their records are lost, all of their equipment, all the work they had done, sort of advanced scientific research in agriculture. They're starting back at least a decade or 2 decades back. So I think that's an example of how that the joy at the U.S. withdrawal might be muted by seeing what kind of damage has been left behind.
Mm-hmm. Catherine Lutz, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Catherine Lutz is with the Watson Institute at Brown University and the author of The Bases of Empire, The Struggle Against U.S. Military Posts. Ra'ed, if you could stay with us for just one moment, I have one final question for you about the future of Iraq. Two issues, one on the military front and one on the economic front. On the military front, how do you see Iraq's future with the influence of Iran, which of course has been very much in the news today? Those who are against the withdrawal of U.S. troops here in this country warn that Iran is going to have much greater influence in Iraq as it's already been supporting these militias in the country. And then also, what do you think about Iraq's oil future?
The Iranian influence in Iraq now is very strong. Iran never had stronger influence in Iraq in the contemporary history. And the strongest influence that Iran has gained in inside Iraq is under the U.S. occupation. So for those who say that the U.S. presence was protecting Iraq from Iranian intervention, they are obviously wrong. And we're not talking here about Iranians sending, bombs in the middle of the night across the border. We're talking about the pro-Iranian parties running the Iraqi government in collaboration with the U.S. The Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution is running major parts of the Iraqi government in collaboration with the U.S. and was funded by the U.S. So from an Iraqi point of view, actually, the U.S. occupation is a blow for the Iranian intervention because from an Iraqi point of view, Iranians and Americans have been collaborating in interfering in Iraq.
Hmm. And
now,
then
whether it was the Iranian intervention or other interventions, I think the first step for ending other interventions is to create a strong, stable, sovereign Iraq that will cut any other interventions, whether it's from Iran or Saudi Arabia or Al-Qaeda or other countries in the region.
And let's talk finally also about Iraq's oil future and economic future. Foreign firms are now bidding on Iraq's oil permits, and many companies have complained that the Iraqi government's conditions are too stringent. What do you think lies in Iraq's future? Is it going to have to depend on its oil to bring its economy back?
The current bidding that's happening now is actually not very bad compared to what the original plan was. The original plan was to sign production sharing agreements that privatize Iraq's oil and give the ownership away to multinational oil companies. There was a major campaign in Iraq that everyone, from the unions and public and parliamentarians, participated in against the oil law. And now, so we reached to these biddings, which are just technical service agreements. They don't privatize the Iraqi oil. Of course, oil in Iraq is one major income. It's between 90 and 95% of the Iraqi GDP, and Iraq will depend on that oil. I think where we stand now, Iraq will have ownership over its oil during the next decades, unlike the original plans of the Bush administration of privatizing it and giving it to multinational oil companies. So I hope the way forward is that Iraqis control their own natural resources, and once Iraq becomes really a sovereign country when the U.S. leaves, that this money should be used for real reconstruction, and corruption inside the current Iraqi government must be dealt with.
Ra'ed Jarrah, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks a lot for having me.
Ra'ed Jarrah is the Iraq consultant to the American Friends Service Committee, and we've been talking about National Sovereignty Day in Iraq, a momentous occasion as U.S. troops finally leave. Of course, they are there are still going to be 130,000 of them in two major military bases, as we've discussed. This is Uprising. Later in the hour, we'll be joined on the phone by Nathiba Lopez, who is a frequent guest on Uprising, a longtime Southern California activist. He's just been charged with four felonies on voter fraud. He'll be joining us to talk about that. We'll also hear today's subversive historian. And after this week's Empire Notes, the W. Kamau bell curve, ending racism in about an hour. Empire Notes are weekly commentaries filed by Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance and The New Crusade. Today's commentary is about the military coup in Honduras.
We live in strange times. A revolutionary movement shouting Allahu Akbar in the streets of Tehran gets adulation from all parts of the American political spectrum. A military coup in a Latin American country described as a wholly owned subsidiary of the United States against an ally of Hugo Chavez is opposed in no uncertain terms by the U.S. government. Perhaps next week George Bush will denounce himself as a war criminal. No sooner did the military coup in Honduras against President Manuel Zelaya occur than one could see left headlines blaring. Obama's first coup. Key leaders of Honduras military coup trained in U.S. Allegations of U.S. involvement are hardly surprising, of course. This would not even have been the first Central American president named Zelaya deposed by us. These suspicions and some were fed by the fact that it took many hours for the Obama administration to come up with an unequivocal statement about events in Honduras. And State Department officials admit they've been working for some time to help resolve the growing constitutional dispute there. In times past, this would certainly have been code for preparing the ground for a coup. In this case, however, it's clear that the United States was not involved and it is opposed to the coup. This does not, however, mean that we're not responsible in some way. The miserable 8 years of George W. Bush validated for many the harshest views of U.S. Latin America policy, with strong approval for one anti-democratic coup in 2002 and heavy involvement in another one in 2004. They represented, however, more a recrudescence of Reagan administration Cold War ideological and militaristic hysteria than continuity with previous policy. It was natural that an incoming Democratic administration would repudiate those stances. Although the Obama administration has fully owned the Bush War on Terror, there are some strong differences. First, they want to turn down the ideological temperature. They talk much less about war, even as they escalated in Pakistan and Afghanistan. They hector less, and they go beyond mere pro forma invocations of Islam as a religion of peace. Second, they have no desire to assimilate the war on terror to the unresolved battles of the Cold War. As far as they're concerned, we won the Cold War, and it's time to let go. The second may well not be a conscious policy change, but the absence of the previous anachronistic Cold War mentality is palpable. Thus, we go from the 2004 elections in El Salvador, where Otto Reich, Roger Noriega, and even Oliver North made various heavy-handed threats about the dangers of electing Shafiq Handal of the FMLN, to 2009, where Hillary Clinton attends Mauricio Funes' inauguration dressed in red. Obama has also indicated perfect willingness to deal with Daniel Ortega of Nicaragua. In this crisis, the administration turned down the chance to make rhetorical attacks on Hugo Chavez, and most interesting, seems to be waiting for the OAS to take the lead, not wanting to throw its weight around. Despite all this, the United States still bears great responsibility for the coup. Of course the key coup plotters were trained in the United States. It would be news if they weren't. The entire Honduran military is stamped made in the USA, and we've been heavily involved in institutionalizing the political power of that military. For decades, Honduras has been a staging area for U.S. dirty wars in Central America. The army that overthrew Arbenz of Guatemala in 1954 is trained there. During the 1980s, Honduras was of critical importance. We started heavy cooperation with the Honduran military in the early 1950s. Shortly afterward, the constitution was changed to recognize the political independence and even dominance of the military over civilian power. In 1982, some changes were made, but they had little to no effect, because it was during this decade that the United States poured in tens of millions of dollars every year to the Honduran military. Only in the 1990s, as the U.S. lost interest in Central America, did some measure of civilian oversight of the military emerge. The constitutionally and historically embedded power of the military is the question that provoked the current political crisis in Honduras. Our complicity in that power is unquestionable. What responsibility do we bear to undo the ill effects of our previous interventions? This is dangerous ground. This sort of argument was used to justify the 2003 Iraq War. But these questions deserve some thought. For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mahajan.
Visit www.empirenotes.org for more information. You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Two Republican Party activists in South Carolina apologized earlier this month for racist jokes made online about Barack and Michelle Obama. Dispelling the notions of a post-racial society, these jokes are just the most recent in a steady stream of racist humor since the inauguration of the nation's first African-American president. In stark contrast, San Francisco-based comedian W. Kamau Bell was noted by Comedy Central as the first person to tell the very first joke about Barack Obama, noting how his name alone would be too controversial for racist voters to swallow.
That's why I hope the black leader we get is Barack Obama, the black senator from Illinois. Yeah. Yeah. That dude is cool. People say he's going to be president someday. My question is, president of what? Because one day there may be a black president, but there will never be a black president named Barack Obama. Ladies and gentlemen, that's too black. That dude's name might as well be Blackie Blackerson. See what I'm saying? And if people won't vote for a white dude named John Kerry, they will definitely not vote for a black dude named Barack Obama. Who's running for president? Barack Obama. Black Osama? Mm-mm. That is two things I don't like. That's like a rotten cherry on a crap Sunday. No, thank you.
And that's W. Kamau Bell. That joke was in line with Bell's current work that weaves through the contentious intersections of race in society with his acclaimed solo show, The W. Kamau Bell Curve, Ending Racism in About an Hour. Inspired by the incendiary style of Bill Hicks, Bell pulls no punches in his punchlines about race relations, interweaving personal experiences and social commentary in a stand-up act set to provoke as much insight as laughter. FlavorPill.com has said of the one-hour show, by making no subject off limits, keeping no discrimination too taboo, and leaving no room for self-denial, Kamau's Bell Curve is not only a powerful comedic performance, but an outlet for a necessary dialogue. W. Kamau Bell is in Los Angeles and in our studios this morning. Welcome to Uprising.
Wow, that was the greatest eulogy I've ever heard. Well, I hope people say that stuff after I'm gone.
Well, but first I'm going to take issue with what we just heard you say.
Feel free. You're not the first.
When did you make this joke?
Let's be clear. That was 2005, mm-hmm. which is why I think I was so ahead of the curve of, you know, nobody was talking about Barack in 2005. He had been at the Democratic Convention in 2004. And there was talk that maybe one day he could be president. And I was just like, I can't see that happening. Apparently, I was wrong. I'll accept that fact.
So he's not too black?
Apparently not, you know. But I like to think of it this way. I was a Trojan horse. I was hired by Oprah and Maya Angelou and Cornel West to really get his name out there to the youth of America. So,
and I did.
I did a good job.
Well, what does his election then mean? Like, how did his election, after saying what you said, change your perception of America?
Well, I mean, I think it there's a lot of things that had to fall into place for Barack to be president, you know, in addition to the fact that we felt like we needed, you know, he was this incredibly good speaker and intelligent and all those things you want in a president. He was matched up against two of the worst presidential candidates of all time, you know, McCain and Palin. It's like a couple of Batman villains.
And then there's also Hillary Clinton.
Yes, and Hillary Clinton. I mean, it was just like, I felt like it was, you know, it's opportunity meets all these things around him, where it's like, I think if Barack had been running against, Ronald Reagan, you know, or something else, I think it would have been different. But he was matched up against, you know, the Penguin and Catwoman. So I feel like it was not really, I think it was a lot of things that had to fall into place. You know, I think the Republicans basically gave up the presidency. They were like, we can't, we don't want it anymore. You know, even they were mad at Bush.
And what about Michelle Obama being this first lady? I mean, we have this very, very charismatic young couple in the White House today that most Americans, particularly most Americans of color, just never expected to see. And let's first talk about how people of color have received it before we talk about how white Americans might receive it. What do you think the repercussions have been? I mean, do people just feel really good about this?
Well, no,
regardless of his policies, right?
Yeah. No, I think that you see two happy and love black people on TV every day, which is not something you've seen since the Cosby Show. You know what I mean? I think that that's a big deal to see, like, Michelle Obama. That's the thing about Barack, because there was that whole, you know, he's our first black president. And he's, you know, he's half, I mean, his mom is white, his dad is black. He could have marched through the White House with, like, a Cindy McCain on his arm, you know, but he didn't. He got a chocolate brown black woman. And, I mean, they're in love. I don't mean, you know, they're. But, I mean, he got this. She's a beautiful representation of what it is to be an African-American woman. And that makes African-Americans really excited, you know, just to see this very engaging, you know, presence in the White House.
But it doesn't make everybody terribly excited, like the two Republican Party activists in South Carolina that I mentioned. There has been, as I said, this sort of string of terribly racist humor, and a lot of it becomes very defensive when people are accused, particularly those folks who make the jokes or write the humor or draw the cartoons and are accused of being racist. There's a lot of defensiveness.
There is. I think the white establishment, can I say white establishment?
Yes, it's KPFK. You can say that.
The white people who are on everything, and I don't mean you white people who are listening, I mean your friends and family. I think that they don't understand that the rules have changed. And I think that they're used to this sort of attitude of sniping at whoever the party is in power, you know, Republicans and Democrats sniping each other. And the rules have changed now because we have a black president and this is a racist America. So you can't be as free with what you would say as you used to. You're not really as much in power as you used to be. And I think they're scrambling. They don't know the rules have changed. They don't know how to operate. No, they're not used to people telling them what they can and can't do.
Let me remind you, if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with W. Kamau Bell, stand-up comedian based in the Bay Area, coming here to Los Angeles. He's here for his Comedy Central performance happening tonight. The taping is happening tonight from 8 to 9 p.m. at the Comedy Central stage at the Hudson, 6539 Santa Monica Boulevard. And that's at Hudson between Highland and Vine. And you can go to the performance. It's a free event. And you can RSVP. I believe there are still seats available. You can RSVP at 323-960-5519. So let's talk about where where an artist like you fits in the age of Obama. We played a little clip of your act, but you just returned from Aspen, where
yes.
They have this annual very large festival of comedy.
Yes.
Are you still atypical? Just to put it bluntly.
Yes, I am still atypical. I think in the world of comedy, yeah. I mean, it's certainly, especially in the world of Aspen comedy, mm-hmm. I think they're 0.49% black, if I looked up their demographics correctly. So, yes, I was very atypical there. But they're still not – I mean, I think a lot of comedians are still trying to figure out how to deal with Barack being president. Whereas I was sort of training for this my whole career. Like, I was always talking. It's like, you know, I feel like Rocky. Finally, I got the fight I wanted, you know. I've been sort of talking about race and trying to do it in different ways. And so I started doing my show in October of 2007. At that point, I wasn't even talking about Barack because he was just this guy who maybe he could be vice president if Hillary lets him. You know, that was not that long ago. And so by the time he sort of started to be a legitimate candidate, I was already talking about race in America and how, you know, racism had made a comeback and how a lot of it was coming through the liberals and all these things I was doing in my show. So by the time he became president, I'd been training for like a year to do this. So
racism has made a comeback in the age of Obama. What does that mean?
Well, I think, it all started, it was funny, about like in 07, there was all that weird celebrity racism that happened. It started with like Michael Richards and Dog the Bounty Hunter. And I mean, like every month some celebrity was doing something like, whoa.
And Radio Shock Jock.
Yeah. And Don, I don't want to say that name. It's like Voldemort. So like there was always some sort of, and I sort of was like, I felt like Russell Crowe in A Beautiful Mind. I was like, is anybody not seeing this? Like I was in my room with like string connecting newspaper articles. And I started doing the show and started talking about it, and then it became clear that, like, it's as the stories kept changing with Barack running for president, like, there was just like, and now we're in this idea of this post-racial America, which people want to impose on the world, which I'm like, and I'm still like, there's still racist things happening every day, you know. I mean, just the Transformers movie just came out with the two jive talking robots. First of all,
I'm going to try not to watch that film.
Yeah. I tried not to watch the first one. That worked out pretty well for me. Not because it was racist, just for other reasons. But it's just the idea of like, how can we live in this country? How can we have, first of all, jive talking robots, which is what Yahoo News said. I'm like, no black person's talked jive since Jimmy Walker on Good Times. But and it's like the idea that people feel like they can defend racism by the robots aren't real, you know. So they shouldn't affect you, the robot. They could have said anything. You know, it's just the idea that people still feel the need to defend their racist doings because it's, you know, it's post-racial America.
Now, in your act, you mentioned that, or you assert that it's not just, you know, white Americans living in rural towns, mm-hmm. The sort of stereotypical white Americans that you would imagine harbor racist notions, but it's liberals.
No, there's I feel like there's multiple levels of racism, and we normally only talk about, like, the really, like, the level five where something, like, a hate crime happens.
Right.
Whereas, like, there's 1 through 5, and if you live in a city where you don't have a lot of fives happen, but you suffer a lot of ones and twos all day, you might feel like fives are happening. You know what I mean? And I think San Francisco is one of those cities where, you know, it's the Bay Area, it's liberal, and yet San Francisco is like 4%, you know, black people, and it's really trying to push the Latinos out of the Latinos out of the Mission. And there's all these things that are happening that you see happening all around you. And I came from Chicago, where Chicago is pretty segregated too, but we're really comfortable talking about it. Black people go over there, white people go over there. Whereas in San Francisco, they just go, no, I don't know why there's not black people. I don't know. They don't want to talk about it. And so it becomes real fun in that city to bring it up and put it in people's faces.
Now, you also talk about your own inner racism.
Yes, my own inner racism. Well, you know, it's not fair to talk about racism and just talk about everybody else's, you know. It's like, I think that...
So is this about reverse racism, like we hear a lot about in the Sonia Sotomayor nomination?
I'm invoking the reverse racism. No, I'll just claim racism. I don't have to invoke but, like, doing stand-up comedy, nothing has made me more racist in my life than just being a stand-up comic and showing up in small towns where suddenly I'm the only black guy, you know, or towns where you walk into the general store and they go, you must be the comedian. Why? Because you're clearly not from here, you know, like, and you start to really feel like I've heard, you know, so you start to take that on in ways. And also, I'm in an interracial relationship. So, you know, me and, you know, the best way to talk about racism every day is to be in an interracial relationship where I'm like, I think that was racist. And Melissa's great, and she'll, like, talk to me about it. Yeah, my wife. We just got married 3 months ago.
Yes. Congratulations.
Yes, we're going to try to make some Obamas. since that's everybody's favorite flavor right now. So we're always having conversations about race and racism. And, you know, and sometimes I have to be like, well, maybe I'm a little touchy. But we've had... you know, although our biggest thing is not race, it's the fact she's Catholic and I'm sane. I'm always confronting my own. I was looking at it myself too. I'm not just pointing at everybody else because that would be ridiculous.
Hmm. So how do you end racism in less than an hour?
Well, we have to pack a lot in.
Let me actually just step back and say, the title of your show is the W. Kamau Bell Curve,
yes.
And that's a play on.
Play on the book, The Bell Curve, you know, which is like, my name is W. Kamau Bell, and when I was thinking of a name for the show about racism, it was like something that hit me like a lightning bolt, like, hey, wait a minute, there's that book, The Bell Curve, which is super racist. And I don't talk about the book in the show, I just enjoy the fact that I can, then this is my version of The Bell Curve, you know. And the show is really topical, and so when things happen in the news, I put them right in the show immediately, and I try to do everything I can to sort of, like, you know, bring up issues that people don't think about and sort of, like, really, And as far as ending racism now, it really gets the discussion going. Like, people always walk into the show talking about what they saw, which is, to me, is the first part of ending racism, is getting people talking about it.
Do you think that Comedy Central taping your performance, which is happening tonight, is...
We need some brown people. Brown people call in. Brown of any shades of brown.
Actually, I should mention that I think I saw somewhere that if you bring a person of a different race to the taping, you get 2 for 1.
Well, you know, well, the show is free tonight. But okay. In general, when I do the show, it's bring a friend of a different race and get in 2 for 1. Not even Martin Luther King had that kind of guarantee.
do you think Comedy Central is giving you a platform and helping open the door for, you know, places like Aspen to be a little bit less, monochromatic?
Well, you know, I think Comedy Central needs a black guy. And I might be that black guy. I mean, I think right now the entertainment industry in general is looking for, you know, new voices that can talk about this America we live in now. And a lot of comics who are hilarious just, you know, are still talking about it in old ways. So it's not that it makes them any less hilarious, whereas I've always been sort of trying to find new ways to talk about it. So I think right now, you know, it may be Brock's time, maybe my time too. Another black guy from Chicago with a chance.
W. Kamau Bell is my guest. The W. Kamau Bell Curve, Ending Racism in Less Than an Hour, is his one-man show happening tonight at the Comedy Central stage at the Hudson at 6539 Santa Monica Boulevard, and that's at Hudson between Highland and Vine. You can RSVP to attend this free show at 323-960-5519, 323-960-5519, and you can also visit his website at wkamaubell.com. I'll spell it, WKAMAUBELL.com. Kamau, finally, in terms of where you see the sort of racist humor that we see coming out constantly, what advice would you give for KPFK listeners in how we respond to that? Because, you know, liberals and particularly leftists are accused of being too touchy on race, and I'm sure you get that accusation a lot. Oh, it's just, we're just being funny. Mm-hmm. Can't you just lighten up? Mm-hmm. You know, how do you respond to these things? Because we're going to have more of it.
Continue to be as touchy as you feel the need to be. I think that's the problem, is sometimes liberals let themselves censor themselves, or progressives let themselves censor themselves. Continue to be as touchy as you want to be and call people on it, because nobody else will. You have to do that.
Well, Kamau, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Best of luck to you and your career, and hope to have you back on someday.
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you.
W. Kamau Bell. Again, his website, wkamaubell.com, and the show is happening tonight at the Comedy Central stage at the Hudson. We'll put all that information on our website as well later today if you missed it at kpfk.org/uprising. After today's Subversive Historian, we'll speak with Nativo Lopez. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Roseanne Barr. Do you think the American healthcare system is broken? Many people do. Believing it costs too much, leaves people out, destroys businesses, and provides lousy healthcare. What's the solution? How about what every other industrialized country in the world has? Single-payer healthcare. It seems to be working for them. Why not us? If you want to find out more, here's something. On Friday, July 2nd at 7:30 p.m., legendary singer-songwriter Ann Feeney is performing a concert at the Musicians Union Auditorium, and there will be information there about single-payer health care to get you started. That's Ann Feeney singing for single-payer health care on Thursday, July 2nd at the Musicians Union in Hollywood, located at 817 North Vine Street, just north of Melrose in the heart of Hollywood. More information is available by calling 213-252-1351 or by visiting the KPFK website at www.kpfk.org. KPFK is a proud media sponsor.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your Subversive Historian. Back in the day, on June 30th, 1936, Haile Selassie, Emperor of Ethiopia, gave an impassioned address to the League of Nations, deploring the invasion of his country by Italy. The international organization had earlier condemned the Mussolini government as an aggressor for its attack on the African nation on October 3rd, 1935. By the time of Selassie's address, Italy had already utilized its air power in addition to chemical weapons such as mustard gas in order to take Ethiopia's capital and claim annexation. Nation. It was shortly thereafter that Emperor Selassie went to Geneva, Switzerland to speak before the League of Nations, asking what measures it was prepared to take against the aggressor in the name of collective security and international morality. Italy would eventually be expelled from the lands of Ethiopia, and Selassie would return to rule it. However, decades later, he would address another international body, this time the United Nations, with very much the same message. For Uprising, this is your truth professor, saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Longtime Southern California activist and frequent Uprising guest Nativo Lopez was brought up on charges last Wednesday of electoral fraud. The California State of Secretary of State has alleged that the tireless advocate for Latino worker and immigrant rights registered to vote in the city of Boyle Heights back in 2006, despite having been a resident of Orange County at the time. In all, Lopez faces four charges, including fraudulent registration, fraudulent voting, document fraud, and perjury. If convicted of the felonies, the national director of Hermandad Mexicana Latinoamericana and the president of the Mexican American Political Association could face up to 3 years in prison. Following the publicized arrest of another Latino activist, Alex Sanchez of Homies Unidos, Lopez states in a recent article in La Opinion that the charges he now faces are baseless. This isn't the first time allegations of electoral wrongdoing have been levied against the activist. In 1997, Lopez was accused but never charged with registering undocumented immigrants to vote. Nativo Lopez now joins me on the line. Welcome to Uprising.
Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks so much for joining us. Well, we've talked to you many times over the years about the immigration situation, about immigrants' rights and the rights of Latinos in Southern California and across the country. This time we're talking about you personally. First, what is your major statement in response to these charges, Nativo?
Well, as I indicated in the interview with La Opinion, they're baseless charges, and it's a political act of piling on the part of the Secretary of State. This is the entity that initiated the investigation originally back in 1996, 1997, and that went on for approximately 3 years, only to conclude that there was nothing there of any substance that they could actually file charges. So the irony that I observed today that back in 1996, 1997, I was investigated as well as my organization by the California Secretary of State, the U.S. Attorney General, the FBI, the Internal Revenue Service, Congress conducted hearings, the Orange County Grand Jury, the Orange County District Attorney, and they never came up with anything. And now for supposedly using a domicile that wasn't mine, they filed felony charges. So,
I guess the main charge is that you are supposed to be living in Orange County, but that you voted in Boyle Heights. Did you vote in Boyle Heights?
That was my domicile, correct.
So you were your actual residence was in Boyle Heights.
That's correct.
At the time that you voted in Boyle Heights.
That's correct, and I only voted once, and I only voted once, and on one occasion. In other words, there was no issue of double voting because that has been alleged in some articles, interestingly.
So it's not like you went and voted in one place and one in one election and then voted in another place in that same election. You just voted in Boyle Heights for one election and in that one place alone.
Absolutely, that's exactly what happened.
What how do you match up these? Four felonies for the act of whatever the case may be, whether or not they find that your residence was in Orange County or Boyle Heights. What does that mean to have four felonies and up to 3 years in prison for this act?
Well, they're serious charges. In other instances, for example, the Secretary of State can handle these as administrative sanctions or administrative violations that could be resolved. They could also charge them through the District Attorney's Office as misdemeanors.
So if, for example, I vote without realizing at a place that I wasn't supposed to because I thought I was in one area but not in another, whatever the reason may be, if I accidentally voted in one place, say it happened, but it was not supposed to be, it was not the place I was supposed to vote in, would the normal penalty be a misdemeanor or these administrative charges?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sanctions,
That's the common practice. That's the norm. But in this particular case, they felt compelled to file four felony charges. So I ask every listener to reflect on their own personal experience of registering to vote at their parents' home with their students, or when they move, the level of transitoryness in our society today, and homelessness and houselessness, and people being foreclosed on and losing jobs, and the mobility that exists in our society, to be fixed and fixated on a domicile in this manner, and then to file four felony charges on these allegations, to me is just over the top politically motivated targeting from an entity that came up short, very short, a decade ago, after spending millions of dollars of investigating me and investigating my organization, and not being able to come up with anything on it.
Nativo, you are no stranger to controversy. The papers, when reporting what has happened to you now, are mentioning that in 2003 you were a school trustee in Santa Ana, but you were recalled amid a heated debate over bilingual education. What do you think is motivating these felony charges? Is it your activism?
Well, you know, it's really hard to know, Sonali. Certainly. With all the issues that I've been involved with, you know, become an irritant to the political and economic elite in Los Angeles County now, for example. We're involved in a very heated organizing campaign against one of the largest, if not the largest, food processing manufacturing companies in California. It's called Overhill Farms, that terminated 300 workers based on supposed alleged discrepancy of Social Security numbers, but it turns out that the majority of these workers that were let go had been in the company for 20, 15, 10 years, and the company turned around and replaced them with part-time employees classified as such, but working them 50, 60 hours a week with no benefits whatsoever, making the minimum wage, while the other workers had a union contract, had benefits, vacation, sick days, a bump above, certainly, minimum wage and health benefits. And we've been on this company now for 3 months. In fact, this Wednesday, tomorrow, we're launching a national boycott against this company and filing a major class action lawsuit. So this is one of the powerhouses of the economic and political elite of this county. So it's not lost on me that coincidentally it happens when we're in the heat of battle with this company. Has terminated that many 300 immigrant workers over the last 6 months. And it's a very, very large plant in a city that's known very, very well for its level of corruption. I'm talking about the city of Vernon.
Now, Nativo, also, what about your work in encouraging immigrants and naturalized citizens to vote and to become active voters? This past election saw a lot of controversy over such issues. I'm recalling the Republican hysteria over the organization ACORN and accusations against them for registering voters who, you know, didn't exist or having these sorts of incidents of voter fraud. Do you think that what you're being accused with and charged with is in the same vein?
Well, I don't know if it's in the same vein. Certainly, we have been involved doing that, encouraging new immigrant citizens to vote, to be involved.
Newly naturalized.
Naturalized citizens to vote, as is their right. But more than their right, it's their obligation. It's their duty. It's their way to open up the door for themselves, their families, you know, those that come behind them. So, and we all know, I mean, this is no secret, you know, that disenfranchisement of low-income workers, of people of color, you know, is the pattern and practice of Republican administrations, whereas the other administrations seek to open up the system a little bit more. I will say, however, you know, this Secretary of State of California has done absolutely zilch in opening the doors and making it easier for people to register to vote and to participate in the political process. I mean, we've edged her, tried to motivate her politically, persuade her to do much more to open up the system, you know, to new voters, to young voters.
Well, we're nearly out of time, Nativo. Well, let me ask you what your plans are at this moment. I'm assuming you've hired an attorney. How do you plan on fighting against these charges, and what solidarity do you hope to get from your fellow activists?
Well, it's already being expressed. We're going to defend against these charges. I have an arraignment on July 8th in the Superior Court in Los Angeles, an excellent attorney who's been with me for over 12 years. And with the organization, and we will defend against these charges and hopefully look forward to questioning the whole constitutionality of domicile and how it's applied by this Secretary of State and others.
And is there any place, any website that you'd like to recommend for listeners?
MAPA.org, that's MAPA.org. We'll have updates about the status of the case.
That's MAPA.org, stands for the Mexican American Political Association, of which Nativo Lopez is the president. He's also the national director of Hermandad Mexicana Latinoamericana. Nativo, thanks so much for joining us. Best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
That's Nativo Lopez. And for Sonali, subversive thought for the day, Abraham Lincoln once said, "Truth is generally the best vindication against slander." That's Abraham Lincoln. That's Sonali's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's program, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Stephanie De Leon is our intern. Melissa Figueroa is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of this program after 10 a.m. today on our website, kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow at 8.